voyage through death to life upon these shores.
This is Poetry Off the Shelf from the Poetry Foundation. I'm Curtis Fox. This week, Middle Passage. The numbers are appalling. An estimated 2 million Africans died in the voyage from Africa to the New World as part of the Atlantic slave trade. The Middle Passage, it's called. And Middle Passage is also the title of a much anthologized poem by Robert Hayden.
People have asked for it, and perhaps now it's time for me to read this poem.
It was published in 1945, and Hayden read it in 1976 at the Library of Congress when he was the poetry consultant there, what we now call the Poet Laureate.
It's long, and it has different voices in it, and I'm not always up to it. I think, though, that I think I can get through it tonight.
Hayden was in his early 30s when he wrote Middle Passage, so it was an older poet reading the work of his younger self.
I wrote it, back in the 40s, when there was very little interest in this kind of subject matter. I read for 2 or 3 years and had to work out a form for it, and I finally did.
Joining me to listen to this recording of Robert Hayden reading Middle Passage is Lavelle Porter, who has written an article about the poem and its reception for our website. Lavelle Porter is a writer and scholar of African-American literature and an assistant professor of English at the New York City College of Technology. Lavelle, we just heard Robert Hayden say that back in the 1940s, there was very little interest in this kind of subject matter. He didn't just mean the Middle Passage. He meant the whole topic of slavery, didn't he?
All right.
Tell us about what was the world he was writing in? And this is in the early 1940s. What was the knowledge? What gave him the idea to do this?
It grew out of his research on the slave trade.
Yeah, he said he spent 2 years doing it.
Yeah, probably more than that. Yeah. Researching the background of the slave trade, and particularly the Amistad case.
Uh-huh.
You know, he spent some time in New York City at the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture.
Up in Harlem.
Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. And some of that research ends up being incorporated into the poem.
Uh-huh. Steven Spielberg obviously hadn't made his movie yet. There was very little known about the whole topic of it. And I understand that the poem was first published in W.E. Du Bois's journal from out of Atlanta. I forgot the name of it.
Phylon. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, and there was information known about it, but there were mostly black scholars who were working on it and working on it outside of the academy. So I think that's what he's referring to when saying there was little interest among the mainstream about the particulars of that history.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of intentional amnesia about what the slave trade was and what it meant.
And here he is thinking, I'm going to write a poem about this, which is kind of a crazy notion, because it's like saying, I want to write a poem about the Holocaust or something. It's a huge, huge topic of massive, incredible suffering over hundreds of years, basically.
Mm-hmm.
So as Hayden said, this poem is long. We're going to listen to all of it, but it's in 3 sections, and we're going to talk between the sections and interrupt Hayden on the fly, rudely. Listeners can read it and hear the whole poem without interruption on the Poetry Foundation's website. Lavelle, can you read for us how Hayden once introduced this first part?
In the opening section, I describe the dreadful conditions aboard the slave ships, the brutal and inhuman treatment of the slaves. The scenes and incidents here are adapted from ships' logs, eyewitness accounts by traders, depositions.
So there's a medley of voices here, and the first thing we hear are the names of some of the slave ships. All right, so here we go.
Middle Passage. Jesus, Estrella, Esperanza, Mercy. Sails flashing to the wind like weapons. Sharks following the moans of fever and the dying. Horror, the corpuscent, and compass rose.
Let me just stop right there, because there's 2 words I don't understand. Corpuscent and compass rose. What are those, nautical terms? What does that mean?
Yeah, it's nautical terms. A lot of nautical terms in the poem.
Mm-hmm.
And that refers to a visible electric discharge on the mast of the ship, also known as St. Elmo's fire.
And compass rose, do you know what that is?
That's a compass to find directions for the ship.
And then here comes the refrain.
Middle Passage. Voyage through death to life upon these shores.
And now a quote begins.
10th April, 1800. Blacks rebellious, crew uneasy. Our linguist says their moaning is a prayer for death, ours and their own. Some try to starve themselves. Lost 3 this morning, leap with crazy laughter to the waiting sharks, sang as they went under.
Lavelle, is that a direct quote from something, or is this an invention?
He adapted this material from actual ship's logs that he read.
And then he goes on with some more names of some of the slave ships.
Desire, Adventure, Tartar, Anne. Standing to America, bringing home black gold, black ivory, black seed. Deep in the festering hole thy father lies. Of his bones New England pews are made. Those are altar lights that were his eyes. Jesus, Savior, pilot me over life's tempestuous sea. We pray that thou wilt grant, O Lord, safe passage to our vessels, bringing heathen souls unto thy chastening. Jesus, Savior.
Now, this is a bit of a shocker when you realize this is not the slaves in the hold that are saying these words. These are the ship's crew, the people that are doing this incredible crime, asking for the deliverance of the Lord.
Yeah, there's a lot of irony in this poem. There's a sort of irony of the way that they're deploying their theological beliefs, you know, praying for safe passage, even as there's this horrible conditions happening.
Yeah.
It's a modernist poem, so it's intentionally elusive.
Mm-hmm.
It also has the modernistic devices of montage. So the way that the ships are presented, the way that there's different scenes in the poem.
Yeah, and that's good. The next scene, it's very collage-y, like you say. Mm-hmm. And here's the next scene is about a pestilence that is on board one particular slave ship. We don't know which one.
Eight bells. I cannot sleep, for I am sick with fear. But writing eases fear a little, since still my eyes can see these words take shape upon the page. And so I write as one would turn to exorcism. 4 days scudding, but now the sea is calm again. Misfortune follows in our wake, like sharks, our grinning tutelary gods. Which one of us has killed an albatross, a plague among our blacks, ophthalmia, blindness. And we have jettisoned the blind to no avail. It spreads, the terrifying sickness spreads. Its claws have scratched sight from the captain's eyes, and there's blindness in the forecastle. And we must sail 3 weeks before we come to port.
So that's a terrifying scene as well. There's right. Some kind of bizarre disease is blinding people, including some of the crew. And as the people in the hold are blinded, they're thrown overboard.
Right.
And obviously the sharks are eating them alive.
And that's absolutely taken from historical facts about slave ships. You know, it was the idea of they wanted to salvage whatever they could when there were illnesses of the sort that would affect their cargo. And so they would throw people overboard. They were expendable.
Yeah. And there's an albatross in this, and one can't help think of Coleridge's Rime of the Ancient Mariner.
Very elusive poem, yeah.
Yeah. And the albatross, of course, bodes ill for sailors, right. Famously. And then there's a sudden switch.
What port awaits us, Davy Jones or home?
Davy Jones is death to a right. sailor, right?
I've heard of slavers drifting, playthings of wind and storm and chance. Their crews gone blind, the jungle hatred crawling up on deck.
And the jungle hatred there, meaning the hatred of the people they've imprisoned down below.
Right.
Thou who walked on Galilee.
And now there's another part of this collage that's thrown in about another ship. And it seems to be from a court case.
The opponent further saith, the Bella J left the Guinea coast with cargo of 500 blacks and odd for the Barracoons of Florida. That there was scarcely room between decks for half the sweltering cattle stowed spoon-fashioned there, that some went mad of thirst and tore their flesh and sucked the blood, that crew and captain lusted with the comeliest of the savage girls kept naked in the cabins, that there was one they called the Guinea Rose, and they cast lots and fought to lie with her, that when the bosun piped all hands, the flames spreading from starboard, already were beyond control, the Negroes howling and their chains entangled with the flames, that the burning blacks could not be reached, that the crew abandoned ship, leaving their shrieking Negresses behind, that the captain perished drunken with the wenches. Further deponent saith not, pilot, O pilot me.
So that's the end of part one, Lavelle, and it's incredibly harrowing. And it's especially harrowing knowing that these are drawn from actual accounts and in court records and things like that. What do you make of this last section?
Well, it speaks to the routine sexual violence that the enslaved were subjected to. And you see that they're, again, also just thinking of them as expendable property. So when the fire breaks out, you know, they just abandoned ship. They just cut their losses.
Yeah.
As it were, it wasn't like they were losing human beings.
Right.
To end that section with, again, the quotation from the hymn,
yes,
just further plays up the irony.
Okay, let's move on to part two, which is quite a bit shorter. These are the reminiscences of an old slave trader to a younger man or a boy. It's unclear here.
Aye, lad. And I have seen those factories, Gambia, Rio Pongo, Calabar. Have watched the artful Mongols setting traps of war, wherein the victor and the vanquished were caught as prizes for our barracoons. Have seen the nigger kings whose vanity and greed turned wild black hides of Felata, Mandingo, Igbo crew to gold for us. And there was one, King Anthracite we called him, fetish face beneath French parasols of brass and orange velvet, impudent mouth whose cups were carven skulls of enemies, would honor us with drum and feast and conjo and palm oil glistening wenches skilled in love, and for 10 crowns that shone with paste, red calico and German silver trinkets, would have the drums talk war and send his warriors to burn the sleeping villages and kill the sick and old and lead the young in coffles to our barracoons. 20 years a traitor, 20 years, for there was wealth aplenty to be harvested from those black fields, and I'd be trading still, but for the fevers melting down my bones.
I guess what's significant about this section is that Hayden is saying the evil was not the exclusive property of white Europeans of the slave trade, because these are African kings who are profiting from the slave trade as well.
Yeah, so this is an interesting sort of moral challenge that he's making here by discussing the complicity of Africans in the slave trade. You know, even though the transatlantic slave trade itself was a different kind of enslavement that was racialized and hereditary in a way that these other forms of trading where people were trading those who they had conquered in war and things like that.
Sell your enemy.
Yeah, right, right.
Old as human history.
That part is, but the idea of establishing a sort of legalized hereditary system of enslavement, that was what chattel slavery was.
Mm-hmm.
There is a difference, you know. This is one of those things that is often thrown back as a retort against slavery. Well, you know, they participated in it too.
Right.
There's no shortage of black writers and scholars who are willing to and have acknowledged that in their writing. And it's an example of that happening here.
But it's not necessarily, as you say, it's probably not an equivalence of evil.
It's definitely evil, but
not an equivalence. It's not a systematic, massive, multi-generational crime.
And that's just factual, yeah. I mean, in terms of the length of it, in terms of the legal structures of slavery, and particularly in the Americas, is a different system.
And the speaker here, he's horrible in so many ways, but not least because he thinks he's better than the African kings who profited like he did from the slave trade. Mm-hmm. But he appears to have caught malaria or some other tropical disease. And by saying so, Hayden somehow manages to humanize him in some ways. This guy is evil, but he's sick. And not that we feel sympathy for him, but he's a human being. He suffers like other people.
There's condescension in his tone towards the Africans who he's doing business with.
Right.
But there's also the idea that, you know, 20 years a trader, he says, I'd still be trading, but for the figures melting down my bones. So he would still gladly be participating in it, that he can't anymore.
He feels like he's missing out on all that stuff. Let's go to the last section. And Hayden later said about it, the third section is climactic. The first two move toward it. It's based on the accounts of the Amistad Mutiny in 1839. It's meant to recapitulate all the themes introduced earlier and focuses on the heroic resistance to slavery introduced at the very beginning. So let's listen to how this section begins.
Shuttles in the rocking loom of history. The dark ships move. The dark ships move. Their bright, ironical names like jests of kindness on a murderer's mouth. Plow through thrashing glister toward Fata Morgana's lucent melting shore. weave toward New World literals that are mirage and myth and actual shore. Voyage through death. Voyage whose chartings are unlove.
So here we have an image of the slave trade moving back and forth across the Atlantic like a loom weaving fabric. And it's hard not to think of the cotton that so many of the slaves would be picking in North America if they made it across. Mm-hmm. What do you make of this section?
He's talking about the role of the transatlantic slave trade in the making of the New World. You know, he's using this metaphor of weaving to describe the creation of the, you know, Atlantic world out of this.
And the wealth.
Trade. Yeah.
Because the thing that they're weaving is wealth.
Mm-hmm.
A charnel stench, a fluvium of living death, spreads outward from the hole, where the living and the dead, the horribly dying, lie interlocked, lie foul with blood and excrement. Deep in the festering hole thy father lies. The corpse of mercy rots with him. Rats eat love's rotting, jellied eyes. But oh, the living look at you with human eyes, whose suffering accuses you, whose hatred reaches through the swill of dark to strike you like a leper's claw. You cannot stare that hatred down or chain the fear that stalks the watches and breathes on you its fetid, scorching breath. Cannot kill the deep, immortal human wish, the timeless will.
The image of a person, or the speaker in the poem, walking into the slavehold and looking at these people, looking back at him with utter hatred. In other words, something is being created here that is not going to go away very easily.
Yeah, and it's a manifestation of the guilt of the enslavers and a delusion that they really don't believe that these are not human beings, that they sort of told themselves that,
right.
But they understand.
They see
very
it. When
clearly.
They go down and they look people in the eyes and they mm-hmm. see what's looking back at them and the people, looking, they see it.
And when you consider the threats of revolt that they had to deal with on these ships, they clearly understood these were people who were not happy to be delivered into the arms of Christianity, but who were going to fight them every step of the way.
Yeah. Okay, so now onto the story of the Amistad, where the Africans took advantage of a storm to attack their captors, killing some of them and forcing some of the others to sail the ship back to Africa. But these white sailors secretly steered the ship in the other direction, and the ship was apprehended off the coast of Connecticut, I believe. The Africans were put on trial, and this purports to be the testimony of a Spanish sailor on the Amistad.
But for the storm that flung up barriers of wind and wave, the Amistad, senores, would have reached the Port of Principe in 2-3 days at most. But for the storm, we should have been prepared for what befell. Swift as the puma's leap it came, there was that interval of noiseless calm filled only with the waters and the rigging's usual sound. Then sudden movement, blows and snarling cries, and they had fallen on us with machete and marlin spike. It was as though the very air, the night itself, were striking us. Exhausted by the rigors of the storm, we were no match for them. Our men went down before the murderous Africans. Our loyal Celestino ran from below with gun and lantern, and I saw, before the cane knife's blinding flash, Cinquez, that surly brute who calls himself a prince, directing, urging on the ghastly work. He hacked the poor mulatto down, and then he turned on me. The decks were slippery when daylight finally came. It sickens me to think of what I saw, of how these apes threw overboard the butchered bodies of our men, true Christians all, like so much jetsam. Enough, enough, the rest is quickly told. Cinquez was forced to spare the two of us, you see, to steer the ship to Africa, and we, like phantoms, doomed to rove the sea, voyage east by day and west by night, deceiving them, hoping for rescue, prisoners on our own vessel, till at length we drifted to the shores of this your land, America, where we were freed from our unspeakable misery. Now we demand, good sirs, the extradition of Cinquez and his accomplices to La Habana. And it distresses us to know There are also many here who seem inclined to justify the mutiny of these blacks. We find it paradoxical indeed that you, whose wealth, whose tree of liberty, are rooted in the labor of your slaves, should suffer the august John Quincy Adams to speak with so much passion of the right of slaves to kill their lawful masters, and with his Roman rhetoric weave a hero's garland for Sanchez. I tell you that we are determined to return to Cuba with our slaves and there see justice done. Sanchez, or let us say the prince, Sanchez shall die. The deep, immortal human wish, the timeless will. Sanchez, its deathless primaveral image, life that transfigures many lives. Voyage through death to life upon these shores.
Now, Lavelle, life upon these shores, that is us he's talking about right there. We are now the life upon these shores. Am I right?
Yeah, that's definitely one interpretation. Yeah. It's open to interpretations. But yes, the idea that the life on the other side was underwritten by this violence that he's described.
Yeah, and he's basically saying this one area of history that's been neglected, I'm writing the poem about it, this must be thought about. This is part of who we are. This is part of the life upon these shores, this mm-hmm. history. So what happened to Sanchez? For those of us who haven't seen the Steven Spielberg movie, what happened finally with this case?
Well, the long story short is that they were freed after the case, after a long dispute over them and who was the rightful owner of this property.
They were freed and did they go back to Africa?
And then they did return back to the continent. Yeah.
Okay. So this is a long, deep, and impressive poem with a lot of history packed into it. What does it say to us right now? You know, the country is grappling with very life and death issues about how African Americans are treated, particularly by law enforcement. What does it say to us now?
It says to all of us that we have to reckon with this history. You know, you think of what the protesters are doing in the streets. Also think about the student protests that are happening on these college campuses where the names of people who were slaveholders are being contested. And this is what they were involved in. You know, there's an argument now about the Harvard Law School and its name. And
even Thomas Jefferson is coming under fire down in Virginia for his slaveholding ways.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. You know, there's a Middle Tennessee State, Nathan Bedford Forrest, who was the founder of the Klan, you know, has his name on a building there, and they're trying to get that changed. So that's what you're dealing with. And you have to really reckon with what this institution actually was. And Hayden tries to represent that in an artistic way. There are historians who were doing this work, but he really wanted to create something more aesthetic and a kind of a myth of what this whole system meant and try to come to terms with it.
Lavelle Porter, thanks so much.
All right, thank you.
You can read Lavelle Porter's piece on Middle Passage and the poem itself and listen to the poem without our interruptions on our website. Do let us know what you think of this podcast. Email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org. The theme music for this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. For Poetry Off the Shelf, I'm Curtis Fox. Thanks for listening.